Keir Starmer, this is for Gaza. You have paid and you will pay a high price for the role that you have played in enabling, encouraging, and covering for the catastrophe presently going on in occupied Palestine in the Gaza Strip. I want to tell Mr. Starmer, above all, that the plates have shifted tonight. And as Jacob Rees-Mogg just said on television, in talking of me as a parliamentary orator of note, that Keir Starmer's problems just got 100 times more serious than they were before today. This is going to spark a movement, a landslide, a shifting of the tectonic plates in scores of parliamentary constituencies, beginning here in the Northwest, in the West Midlands, in London, from Ilford to Bethnal Green and Bow. Labour is on notice that they have lost the confidence of millions of their voters who loyally and traditionally voted for them generation after generation. Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak are two cheeks of the same backside, and they both got well and truly spanked tonight here in Rochdale.
I think that this is, on the one hand, you can say, let's not read too much into it, because it's not the first time that George Galloway has gotten elected in a by-election in charge of a left populist political party that basically serves as a kind of force projection apparatus for his own personality. I think it was the Respect Party last time. He's been doing this ever since he got kicked out of the Labour Party in the early 2000s for opposing the Iraq War.
Huh. So you can't be in the Labour and oppose the Iraq War.
Well, yeah, but basically, if this is actually a thing and not just another one-off fluke, and it seems like it might actually be more of a thing this time, this is finally the British Labour left understanding that the Labour Party is dead and no longer has any... There is no prospect of taking it back for Labour. And that realization happened after the party apparatus fucked Corbyn, I think. And yeah, so we'll see. I mean, there's a possibility that he could sort of... Because the election looks like it's going to be so good for Labour because the Conservatives have imploded, ironically, that is good for Galloway because it means that voters are going to be less likely to tactically vote Labour, right? Because they're going to say, "Oh, well, Labour's going to do fine anyway. I can vote my conscience. I'll vote for the Workers' Party, which is Galloway's party." So, you could see this as a really good opportunity for him, and that would be great if he actually pulled something off. If he won a dozen, two dozen seats, that would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think this is happening? I mean, this may be obvious. What do you guys think?
George Galloway's platform, I think we can start there, is a very worker-focused, anti-woke, and anti-imperialist platform. The party as a whole, but his platform for his campaign as well. And he really leaned into the issue of Gaza, attacking the establishment for supporting U.S. and Israel. And, okay, I think, in this election, it happens that a big part of this constituency is Muslim. And, Galloway, played that to his favor to great effect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Those, I think those two, those two parts of his platform seem to pay off.
So when you say anti-woke, I mean, just one thought, you mean basically doesn't go down the identity political path?
Right.
And it doesn't accept this sort of neoliberal compromise, sort of civil liberties for identity groups instead of class-based political economic issues.
Right.
Yeah. And on every major kind of fault line, Galloway is what you would call, quote unquote, on the conservative side of it when it comes to culture war issues, right? And obviously in Britain, the culture war issues are a little bit different from the United States. Abortion is not really a culture war issue. But the main ones in Britain are immigration and, let's say, gender stuff, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Britain has a very strong second wave feminist kind of what in American online culture you would call TERF sort of movement. Galloway has been quite chummy with them.
I see.
He's been not very willing to play the gender politics game. And then on immigration, Galloway has said basically that unlimited immigration is not in the best interest of the British working class, while making clear that, in his view, once you're in the United Kingdom, you should have full labor rights. But he thinks that the UK should be reducing the amount of immigration that it takes in, which, of course, to the traditional activist left is absolutely inconceivable as a stance, right? And in this respect, he resembles Zara Wagenknecht in Germany, who basically has the same stance, which is, once you're here, you should be treated humanely, but that doesn't mean that we have to take everyone. It doesn't mean that we should have unlimited immigration, right? So I think Galloway's, this latest incarnation of Galloway's politics is perhaps a more refined synthesis than in the past. You know, with the Respect Party, Galloway was really all in on foreign policy, kind of as his main he was expelled from the Labour Party for opposing the Iraq War. So I think that was
that
the issue.
That tells you something already.
It was the issue that he personally was most aggrieved about, right? And so it's what he really foregrounded in his last political adventure. But this time he's foregrounding it, particularly with Gaza, but he's also kind of tying this together into a broader kind of critique of British politics, of the Labour Party abandoning the working class, of the need for a return to some sort of socialist economic policy. And the synthesis seems to be working quite well, you know?
Yeah, and it's not only happening there. There are a number of things you said I kind of want to go back to and pick out so that we can address them maybe one by one. The first one is this idea that you can be politically, either because you believe that's the right way to go, or maybe strategically, you could be, let's say, moderately traditional on cultural issues, you know, either for strategic reasons, because most people are, or because you think that, you know, that's the way it should be. He definitely seems to be taking one of those, as, you know, is the case with Sarah Wagenknecht, and seems to be having, these people seem to be having some success with it. Whereas, you know, the more like extremist, left-wing, avant-gardist type, maybe PMC leftism, is gung-ho on the cultural issues, radicalism there, and just thinks that the majority of people is hopelessly left behind culturally and doesn't give a shit if they're left in the dust. So, for example, on this immigration question, the very suggestion that some policy, inevitably, whatever it is, open borders or anything, some policy has to be decided and made. And you're going to have to draw the line somewhere, even just to recognize this issue. I mean, that's the cross on which Angela Nagel was crucified among the Twitter leftists.
Yep.
And I just think, you know, that's a good example. That's a good example for a certain strain of, you know, loudmouth leftists in North America, English speaking world. You're not a left. You're not on the left anymore if you don't toe the line on issues like that. And he just seems to me to be representing an older vintage of leftism, which maybe isn't the left anymore. Maybe it's Maybe it's maybe he's the last dinosaur, but I mean the old left,
yeah,
before the new left,
right,
was not satisfied with cultural substitutes,
right,
and I can understand maybe why PMC leftists want open borders, because they're all educated professionals and they want to seek the highest return on their investment in their education, but you know what, most people aren't looking for a promotion because for the rest of their lives they're not, you know, expecting to go upward anywhere. What they need is a secure place. They need health care. They need a stable job. And the prospects and the horizon are just totally different. And if people come in who are willing to work for lower wages, that's great for capitalists, and it's not good for manual workers. So there's a rift in the working class there. And what I see when I see people talk shit about George Galloway, to put it frankly, or people like this, it's PMC leftists who see that people like George Galloway or Sarah Wagenknecht are advocating the interests of manual workers and not intellectual workers.
It's been... So I think Galloway is cut from the same cloth, fundamentally, as a Corbyn or a Bernie Sanders, but he has, perhaps due to his own cantankerous personality, and perhaps due to the fact that he was exiled earlier and more forcefully from the PMC-dominated center-left than either Corbyn or Sanders were, right? Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party after Galloway had already been expelled, right? Bernie came very close to winning, or came reasonably close to winning the Democratic presidential primary long after Galloway had been expelled. So Galloway was expelled early enough that he's kind of been able to develop a personal political style that is more intransigent with regard to PMC politics than either Corbyn or Sanders, right? Like, it was obvious in 2016, for example, that Sanders wasn't really he wasn't really comfortable with a lot of the identitarian stuff that had cropped up on the left, but he was not willing to actually fight it, right? Mm-hmm. He felt that he had no choice but to go along with it, and that wound up driving a very serious wedge right through the heart of his political coalition that was never able to resolve, right? Mm-hmm. Galloway, because he didn't have to cohabitate with these people, was able to say, no, we're just not doing that, mm-hmm. right? We're not going to put up with this in our political movement. And it's finally paying off for him, right? In the same way that Wagenknecht felt at a certain point after she tried to cohabitate with the PMC leftoids in the left party in Germany for so long, eventually she said, "We can't do this. We can't do this anymore. It's impossible to have both of these types of politics cohabitating in one political coalition. We have to just cut ourselves off from them and try to make our own way." And from the look of the polling, it seems to be working out pretty well for her too. And you compare that, to what's been going on in France, where France Insoumise and Mélenchon initially seemed like they were going to be able to walk this line, but because they didn't actually win power, they've been relegated to opposition. Their political coalition is so fragile that they're constantly relitigating these same internal issues, and it really saps a lot of their momentum and a lot of their focus. So I think there is something to be said for through various happy accidents, Galloway is in a position to kind of demonstrate the way forward for working class politics, and it has to entail a radical rejection of the kind of woke shibboleths and the woke capture, PMC capture that most of the Western left is dealing with.
Yeah, the thing though, so Sanders was never really in it, or at least not for a long time, because the analogous case to the shift in labor with Tony Blair, I mean, don't forget, Margaret Thatcher said our greatest victory is that Tony Blair is what counts as labor. Thatcher shifted the whole picture rightward, and so I mean, that was 90. He was expelled from the Labour Party around the time of the Iraq War. Really dirty. They really did him dirty. But, I mean, the analogous shift in America was in 68 and 72. So that had been a long time ago that the Democratic Party abandoned manual labor and switched to a minority PMC coalition alliance type thing. And so it seems to me what we're seeing is that... And this does correspond to the Wagenknecht case, and she's not perfect by any means, but it is, you know, they're being carved on the same lines. What you see is that there's a kind of like middle class or upper middle class leftism, which doesn't give a shit what happens to the manual workers, frankly, as long as we're good on all these box ticking issues. And then if you do that, if you go down that path, the people who work with their hands or who just get left in the dust, I mean, they're going to vote for whoever they think listens to them. And so there's this kind of tension or contradiction within the left between class strata, the manual and the intellectual workers. And I mean, he seems to be having some luck with the workers. What is the Workers' Party of Britain?
Yep.
With the Workers' Party of Britain, you know, saying, you know, we're basically old left. No culture, political economy, class. But I mean, a lot of leftists in Europe, and so the NATO sphere, they think, you know, forget the workers. If we don't have these cultural political issues, it's not worth anything anyways. And then they'll call, I guess they call him a Putin puppet,
you know, all sorts of. Well, so the interesting thing here is that Galloway has finally been able to conjoin this old class left message with a very strident anti-imperialist foreign policy stance, right? This is kind of the breakout moment for Galloway. And it's because the West is confronting two major foreign policy crises that really go to the heart of the American-led liberal hegemonic world order, right? One is the Ukraine war, which has been festering for quite some time, but it's finally getting to the point where even the Washington foreign policy elite and the foreign policy establishment in various European capitals realizes that Ukraine's toast. Right?
Victoria Nuland is gone.
Ukraine is obviously going to lose and is obviously going to surrender at least a couple oblasts to Russia. Putin's fine. Russia is stronger than it was prior to the Ukraine war economically, militarily, diplomatically, in terms of its relationships with you know, peripheral regional powers like Iran. So the foreign policy establishment has been dealt an extremely crushing blow. And the other one is Gaza, which, you know, happened all of a sudden, but it's escalated so rapidly, and it's become such it has been able to kind of displace all of the old leftoid activist preoccupations around gender, around Black Lives Matter, around all this other stuff. None of those things are relevant anymore because all of that energy is being funneled towards opposition to what's happening in Gaza. And unlike gender and Black Lives Matter, I think we're finding that opposition to the Israeli genocide in Gaza is not alienating or divisive within the broader populist sphere, right? The problem with something like Black Lives Matter is that the activists were on one side of the issue, and a lot of the regular working people who should have been the audience for left populist politics were on the other side of that same issue, right? And so there was a cleavage between what the activists were interested in and what regular people were interested in. With Gaza, it doesn't appear that that's the case. It seems that the activist preoccupation with Gaza is not actually alienating regular people. It seems like regular people are also pretty concerned about Gaza, even if they're not concerned to the same extent as the activists, which is quite different from previous kind of cyclical activist preoccupations, right? And I think this is one of the reasons that Galloway was able to lean in 100% on Gaza, because both wings of his coalition, insofar as he has sort of a leftoid activist component to his coalition, which I'm sure he does, right?
Right, sure.
He's able to lean in on Gaza and satisfy both the regular working people and in his particular district, obviously the Muslim population is also a consideration, and he also satisfies the kind of dilettante activist idiots, right? It's a win-win for him, and this has not been the case in the past.
Hmm.
So this is kind of an alignment of the stars.
Right. Right, I think it is. And we're going to start, we're going to see this particular alignment continue, I think, because just like with Ukraine, right, for a long time, you know, opposition to the war in Ukraine, it was obvious that...
I mean, this conflict has been going on for 10 years.
Right. And it was obvious initially that there was some kind of populist interest in opposing the war in Ukraine, but it wasn't really like galvanizing people, right? But at this point, I think opposition to the war in Ukraine, particularly in Europe, where countries have been dealing with the economic ramifications due to the energy crisis, it's getting to the point where you can go out and you can stridently oppose the war in Ukraine, and regular working people who in past years would have just shrugged their shoulders, been like, I don't really care, you know, what happens in Ukraine. Now they're the connection has been made to inflation. The connection has been made to your energy bill, right? Mm-hmm. And now regular working people are saying, yeah, why are we still in Ukraine?
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of the leftoid fanatic types, I think, when they hear some slogan like America First, they lose their minds. But I mean, a lot of the people I've heard say that when they say what they mean by that. So it's not this sort of like college educated type approach, and you know, it's kind of crude. But I think the idea behind that for many of the people, not all of them, but is, you know, why are we sending money to Ukraine when we have so many problems here? It's a kind of naive populist view. I mean, of course, there are reasons why. The reasons why we're sending, why aid is sent to countries when people are suffering here is because geopolitical interests of the empire. But I think the idea there, the sentiment, I mean, is something that the old left would have said. And that's what's so weird, is that you get right-wing people saying old left talking points. I mean, you're so used to hearing leftists say, oh, to barking you down, saying, oh, you're rehearsing right-wing talking points. Well, the thing about realignment is that we're in this weird moment where people who sound conservative, they're saying old left talking points. And the question is what you do with that. And I think you'd be a fool not to run with it, right?
Yep. Well, I mean, and you can see this in the United States as well, right? Like Tucker went and interviewed Putin, right? Tucker and Candace Owens have basically come out as anti-Zionists. They're reinventing Pat Buchanan-style paleoconservatism in the American right populist media ecosystem, and it's working. Like, there's a huge appetite for this, right? There's a huge appetite among the populist right, among Trump's erstwhile base, for anti-Zionist politics, which I don't think anyone would have seen a couple years ago, right? So, obviously, political entrepreneurs and media entrepreneurs are identifying these cleavages within the existing right-wing coalition. And politicians like Galloway are who is also a political entrepreneur, obviously, is identifying ways that he can stitch together a coalition of rank and file working class people who might vote Labor, might vote conservative, you know, into a new political coalition that is actually in agreement on these issues. And these issues are both domestic economic policy issues and their foreign policy issues that he has been able to successfully frame as directly impacting people's day-to-day lives accurately. And Wagenknecht is doing the same thing in Germany, right? She went before the Bundestag and made that speech where she basically said, you know, you people are all crazy, you know, like this insane war in Ukraine is contributing to our current economic crisis. So, you know, I think the establishment has really, they got very complacent and they thought that their divide and rule strategy, this identitarian kind of, we'll play different parts of the working class off against each other indefinitely, and it's just going to work forever. It's not going to work forever. Eventually, that kind of strategy is going to have diminishing returns, and I think we're seeing that right now.
I think the Workers' Party of Britain is aware of the point you just made of you know, realignment, and it seems like they're trying to move away from the designation as leftists. Jyoti Brar, I'm not sure what her position in the party is, was on the record for saying, we don't really identify as left anymore because, you know, leftism has become basically liberalism, the left wing of capital ideology, of identity politics. And we don't need left unity. We really just need class unity, the unity of the working class.
So yeah, let's just play that clip real quick.
We in the Workers' Party, in fact, increasingly don't identify ourselves as left, because left to us has become synonymous with liberalism, with left wing of capitalist politics, with identity politics that divide and divert our movement, with all kinds of lifestyleisms that have no connection with the working class and no connection whatsoever with socialism. Of course, anyone who genuinely wants to fight imperialism and work for socialism will agree that workers' only strength is in their numbers, and we therefore have a duty to help them to unify as far as possible, to help the working class to unify, not the self-identifying left, the working class. We have a different understanding of the path to that unity. We want to go, and we have started to go, to the workers where they are, in their workplaces and their communities, and reintroduce them to the notion of class. Not just the workers who already identify as left, who already understand that they're in the working class, all the workers, whatever their prejudices, whatever the things they might, the attitudes they might have that some people in here might find uncomfortable, we want to talk to everybody, because if you're working class, your interest is in socialism, whether you realize it now or not. Rebuilding class-conscious politics means reminding workers that they are part of a class with definite interests, which are diametrically opposed to the interests of our rulers. It means proving to them that the present system can never solve their problems and winning them to the cause of socialism.
All right, so what do you think?
It seems true. It seems true that the left today, as we, you know, as a historical movement in the U.S. and in, you know, the broader Western world in Europe, is just the left wing of capital, identity politics, which is which really appeals to the middle class and, you know, their interests, I suppose. I mean, I wouldn't even say that it really appeals to their interests.
Yeah, it's
but
kind of a sham anyways.
Yeah, it's kind of...
Because it's not like they're not downwardly mobile, most of them.
Right.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I think that Galloway, by dint of his innate stubbornness, has just kind of... He's kept his focus on these bread and butter issues as the rest of the left has moved away from them. Mm-hmm. And now he's the only guy occupying this territory. Mm-hmm. And I think that Jody Brar is right to say that at this point, you don't have to care what the rest of the left is doing or interested in, because they have long since severed any connection to the actual working class. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of talking to working people and reintroducing them to the fundamental message of socialism, right? Mm-hmm. That is innately attractive to anyone who works for a living, if you don't lard it up with all this bullshit, right?
Basically, I mean, the way she puts it is, you know, we're not addressing the self-designating left. We're not talking about unifying people who consider themselves leftist. These are opinions. These are mental conceptions which some people have. I consider myself left. The thing about class is that it's an objective category. It doesn't really matter what you think. It's sort of beneath the radar of what you think. It's what you do. It's what you do in the economy, and it's most people. But, you know, the self-identifying left, I mean, people who call themselves leftists, they are a minority. They're a minority. It's, you know, upper-middle-class educated people. And, you know, just in passing, I want to note something here, which I think is a pretty hilarious irony. I mean, there used to be this... So the theory of imperialism, like, you know, read maybe in Lenin... He says, in Britain, so why is the working class in Britain so conservative and reactionary? Well, because the working class in Britain gets higher wages than normal because it's in the empirical core. So they enjoy certain privileges. They're a labor aristocracy. That's the frame he used. And so this term survives, and I don't think it applies so much to working class people in the first world in so-called first world anymore. But the funny thing is where labor aristocracy does kind of apply is in these identitarian leftists. You look at the self-designating left, the people who call themselves leftists, they're the people who enjoy the so-called privileges.
How?
So you gatekeep jobs with credentials. You get bullshit jobs. Meanwhile, jobs are being offshored or automated away. You could work as a nurse in a nursing home for the aging population until they're dead. But I mean, it still only get $25 an hour. But there is this minority of sort of like Brahmin caste, you know, liberal leftists. And the thing about them, why I say actually the labor aristocracy is the PMC, they're a pro-imperialist left. Lenin's question about the labor aristocracy was, why is the British working class pro-imperialist? Shouldn't they side with their brothers in the third world? And the thing is, you know, you look at the left and they're siding with, you know, they're saying, you know,
yeah, we have to fight Ukraine. They're siding with Ukraine, yeah.
They're siding with Ukraine until the last Ukrainian is gone. And you know, the contemporary left is pro-imperialist. Well, they're okay with empire.
I think that something shifted. So it's true that in the initial phases of the Ukraine war, the activist left was, if not pro-Ukraine, it was at least very ambivalent and divided, right? There was zero anti-imperialist consciousness, right? You did not have a group like the DSA coming out and illustrating how the Ukraine war was actually provoked by NATO and was in the service of American imperial hegemony.
They say Russia's the imperial force,
right?
There,
right.
Which is just mind-boggling,
right? But I think this has shifted, right? And as the Ukraine war, at least in the United States, it shifted. In Europe, I think it's correct. You're correct that the kind of activist left is still very anti-Russia. It's very Russophobic, right?
Leftists in this country hate Vladimir Putin. Like, he's personally responsible for everything.
I don't think that leftists in the United States are really paying attention to Ukraine that much anymore.
Oh, it's just changed?
I think that they've kind of lost... They were never really that interested in the first place, and they've kind of lost interest.
But isn't Vladimir Putin interfering with our elections and so forth?
But leftists don't say that in the United States. Like, normal Democrats say that. But, like...
Yeah, but all the self-designating leftists in this country, I think who Jody Brar would have in mind with the activist layer, I mean, those people are all talking a mean game 6 days a week, and then they vote for Democrats.
Well, they would have, except it doesn't really seem like that's what they're doing, and that ironically is because of another foreign policy issue. It's because of Gaza, right?
That turned it a little bit.
That changed things, right?
Well, that's the inconsistency of their position,
right? And so I think that there's something going on, you know, with, at least in the United States, there's something going on with the activist left where its initial kind of political incoherence and stupidity kind of led it down some very strange paths with regard to Ukraine. But because Gaza is a moral crusade, and because the activist left just loves moral crusades, it cannot get enough of moral crusades.
Jesus.
They've kind of accidentally corrected their politics on foreign
policy. Well, it's because they're not the master of their own thoughts.
Right.
You tell them to say no. And
right.
I think stupidity is the right word there, because the issue of Ukraine was, I guess, sufficiently muddy enough.
Right. It wasn't a moral crusade. And so they didn't know who to support. Right.
Right.
Some of them.
Well, you have people like Slavoj Žižek saying that George Bush and Vladimir Putin should be judged by the same standard. Who the fuck is going to hold them both to the same standard? I mean, that's a good example.
Well, and if you judge them by the same standard in terms of how many people they killed, respectively, I mean, it's clear that George Bush killed a lot more people.
Right.
So go ahead and judge them by the same standard, and you'll see that one of them comes off a lot better, right? But
well, but that's an example of a prominent leftist who is basically shilling for empire.
Yeah, well, Žižek's really gotten weird. I don't know if he's always been this way, and I never noticed, but his kind of rabid Russophobia, and, you know, I guess he's Slovenian, and, you know, maybe there's some history there, but Yeah, but so I don't know. I think that, you know, and again, Galloway kind of picked Gaza to be his flagship issue for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. And we're seeing in the United States that the one issue that has actually galvanized the activist PMC left into opposition to the Democratic Party is Gaza, right? This is the one thing.
Well, moral issues have traction right. with these people rather than, you know, like class-based political economic issues, presumably because they're comfortable enough to right. to hold out.
Right.
Which is why I say alignment of the stars.
Right.
Because I don't know how durable this coalition will be. Who knows how long the Gaza issue will right. take and
right.
how,
yeah.
how it's going
to terms of in terms of the long-term ramifications of this, I don't know. But I do think that Gaza is opening up a lot of doors that may not close when it's blown over, right? Like, for one thing, I think because it's given the activist left a moral crusade that is not alienating to the broad population, it may kind of teach them that you don't actually have to only do these kind of quixotic moral crusades and tilt at windmills that piss everyone else off, right? You can actually...
No, they'll never learn anything.
Oh, yeah. <Maybe. laughs>
It might just give them points, which is right. what occurred to me. You know, if turning from Ukraine to Gaza, the leftoid weirdo identity politics people look more reasonable to normal people, that might help them too. That which is, you know, frightening because, you know, when you think about it, just compare the situation Israel-Palestine with Ukraine-Russia. They're both, they're both living from American funding and weapons for those geopolitical interests. And I don't understand how leftists can square that circle in their mind. What they say, you know, they say Palestine, the American leftists say, you know, Palestine good, Ukraine good. That just doesn't seem consistent to me.
Well, it's because they're viewing this in terms of who's the aggressor, right?
Uh-huh.
Like that's, you know, they're not looking at this as a kind of realist foreign policy, like qui bono, who benefits from war, et cetera, et cetera. They're basically looking at this as who is invading and who is defending, and they're siding with who is, quote unquote.
So they're siding defending. With the victim every time.
Right. They're siding with the victim, and Ukraine is the victim because Russia, quote unquote, invaded, and Palestine is the victim because Israel invaded, right? It's not
so NATO
about,
didn't throw the first punch, and therefore NATO's right. not the aggressor.
Right, exactly. And you can make the argument to them, which obviously, you know, people like Mearsheimer are making this argument that NATO boxed Russia in such a way that it had to throw that punch, right? There was no, geopolitically, there was no alternative to throwing that punch. But the average American activist leftist doesn't have this conception of realpolitik, doesn't have this conception of the long-term geostrategic interests of great powers, right? Like, it's all a morality play to them.
Yeah, and this same argument has been made on the Gaza issue. People accusing of Hamas of being the aggressors of on October 7th, and therefore Israel is justified. Obviously, big difference, but maybe one difference, you know, at least, you know, really visible is that Russia's the bigger.
Right.
Russia's the bigger
right,
aggressor on that conflict, and so they're gonna. They're right. going to take the blame.
Right. I think you're right that to a certain extent, it's about who threw the first punch. And to a certain extent, it's which is the more powerful party. Right.
Yeah.
And so the activist left just instinctively sides with whoever is perceived to be weaker. So it's obvious that they'll be more sympathetic to Ukraine, though. I do think it's important to kind of. I don't think that, at least in the United States, the rank and file activist left ever really cared about Ukraine that much. You know, I don't think this was ever a top issue for them. I think that it never really broke through the static.
Man, I remember, so when this first broke, there were Ukrainian flags everywhere throughout Chicago.
Yeah, but that was not the activist left. That was like normie libs.
Yeah,
that was just like Democrats. Regular Democrats.
I mean, whenever, okay, so sometimes I, you know, one of those days you wake up and you think, oh, I think I'll do something sad today. So I open Facebook and there are still people with Ukrainian flags in their profiles.
Yeah, but I think the center of gravity of the Ukrainian flag stuff was not the activist left, right? There was some spillover, I'm sure, because obviously the boundary between normie Democrat and activist leftist is extremely porous, and oftentimes you can't tell the difference, right? But if you look at this as kind of a spectrum, I think the center of gravity of pro-Ukraine sentiment in the United States was much more solidly on the kind of normie Democrat side of things. And that, it goes back to the Russophobia, the Russiagate allegations that the Democrats were leveling against Trump, right?
Like, right.
Like
we have Trump because of the Russians.
Right. The Democratic establishment has been cultivating this Russophobic orientation within their base for years. And so, of course, their base was primed to get really, really upset about this.
Yeah, and the liberals were always like this. I mean, there was anti-Russian leftism.
Yeah.
That's not new.
Right. So, you know, I there was some of this going on in the activist left, but I don't think it never really displaced the paramount concerns for the activist left, which are gender and race, right? Like that's even during,
to the extent that Putin is this, you know, incarnation of intolerance and regressive patriarchal. I'm just telling you what I hear.
But I don't think the activist left ever really invested
Well, it's hard to tell because it changes day to day.
Yeah, but I mean, for the last several years, the activist left has been all in on their usual concerns, which revolve around, you know, gender shit and police brutality. They've still been doing that. I have not really seen much of them saying anything about Ukraine, right?
Mm.
In Europe, I'm sure this has been very different because Ukraine is in Europe and the consequences of this conflict are much more immediate for the European left. But in the United States, I don't think it was really ever a concern.
Okay. All right. I want to talk about one other thing. I don't know if you think this makes sense, but so with Keir Starmer and the purges in the Labor Party, similarly here in the States, I felt like it was kind of similar with Sanders, but it seems like there's this, you know, controlled opposition problem where, Galloway gets booted for opposing the Iraq War. From the Labor Party, the party is so like taken over by cozy middle class stuff. It's not really a Labor Party anymore. Then along comes this guy Jeremy Corbyn. He's like weak tea compared to Tony Benn and George Galloway. But then even he gets purged because of this anti-Semitism accusations. Like if there's one bad person in the Labor Party, we can't take a single step forward. And now you got Keir Starmer. And
who's an intelligence plant for sure.
Like, yeah, I mean, just look at him.
The clearest example I can think of a prominent politician who's just obviously has some kind of intelligence connection.
And no sooner does he win than George Galloway wins without the Labor Party.
Yep.
So it seems like this controlled opposition stuff, it just reminds me of Mean Girls. Like, you try to edge people out and you end up turning people against you. And I can't help but feel this, America's trying to edge Russia out, sanction Iran out of existence, pushing all of these people out of the dollar system and so forth. And then they say, okay, fine, we're going to come up with our own way and we're going to come up with institutions to find alternatives and we don't need you. And so it sort of backfires potentially. And
for
it seems
sure.
similar.
For sure. I think that fundamentally the Western establishment has miscalculated, and I think this is from a point of weakness, right? Like, the Western establishment is becoming so much less tolerant of opposition because it realizes how vulnerable and unpopular it's becoming. And so with controlled opposition, there's this balance. You have to control it, but it has to be opposition, right? That is to say, it has to convincingly seem and act like an opposition, in order for people to invest their hopes in it.
You have to let it be a little bit.
Right. You have to let it be an opposition. And then when the pedal really hits the metal, that's when you exert your control to rein it in from doing things that you actually can't tolerate. But
but now it's just obviously fake.
Now it's obviously fake, which means that people are decamping for opposition that you don't control, which is not what the establishment wants, but it's kind of the bed they made for themselves, right? If they had allowed Corbyn to win,
they might have had power.
They might have, you know, they could have basically controlled him while he was prime minister and done more damage to him, you know, and his political movement than they have by allowing him to discredit himself, right?
One quick thing, though. Just dawned on me, there might be an assumption in what we're saying that might not make sense to some people. You say that if they let him win, then they might have been able to rule through him. Who are they? I mean, the assumption here is that you have something like a duopoly where a donor class is really in charge, and these people are just allowed to hold the fake baby steering wheel in the passenger seat of the baby in the car.
Right. And I think that's pretty much, particularly in the United States and the United Kingdom, that's how things work, right? Mm-hmm. Like the two-party system, which exists in both countries, though it's more entrenched in the United States than it is in the UK, works by giving the population the illusion of choice between two different political parties that actually are controlled by the same network of money and interest behind the scenes, right?
So dad beats you and mom gives you hugs and you think mom's good, but actually
mom is aiding and abetting dad, right? That's the point.
That's the Republicans and the Democrats.
Right, and that's the Conservatives and Labor, right? But in the United Kingdom, you know, the establishment really went all out to retain their control over labor.
They overdid it.
They viewed Corbyn as such an existential threat to the duopoly that they'd established under Blair that they couldn't tolerate him becoming prime minister, even though they still would have retained enough influence within the Labour Party to basically cripple him as prime minister and make it so he couldn't actually accomplish anything. They were so panicked that they did what they did, right? They sabotaged his electoral campaign, and then as soon as Keir Starmer, you know, wins the leadership of Labour, they kick Corbyn out of the party and they systematically purge his supporters, right? But by doing that...
And then you get George Galloway.
By doing that, you get George Galloway, right?
Yeah, I think I have a slightly different understanding of the situation. Okay. I agree with Daniel's characterization that, you know, the real analog to this was the American analog to the leftist purge of... the purge of leftists of Labour is...
McGovern in the 70s, yeah. After Hubert Humphrey.
Yeah, McGovern in the 70s. This is, I don't know if this is so much like the miscalculation of big players. To an extent you could say it is, but I think it's, I'm seeing bigger forces at play here, and I think the neoliberal, first of all, the establishment, by which we could mean the donor class, is always going to push back against populist, leftist insurgents as best they can. And when you get insurgents take, you know, seats of power, it's because they took it, you know. And the defeat of the left in America, the defeat of the left in Labour in the UK, is just part of a bigger trend of neoliberalism and privatization. And I think, you know, the real leftists in both the UK, Europe, America are sort of, they're seeing defeat. They're just thoroughly defeated. And you know, I think that's what's happening, and I think they just realize that no matter how much you could push within the, you know, the established parties, they're not budging an inch. Mm-hmm. They're just not budging an inch. So,
because you know, they'll have the power, even if they'll lose one candidate after the next, and they don't care.
Right. There's no point in contesting the Democratic primary anymore because we saw what they did with Bernie. Right, and in the UK, I think the old school kind of labor supporting. The UK has a much more robust class left than the United States does, right? And so the large numbers of working class labor voters are it's finally dawning on them that the party has been irretrievably lost, right? There is no chance of getting the Labour Party back after what they did to Corbyn. So now they're looking for alternatives, and this is where Galloway comes from, right? In the United States, we're in a different position because people have given up on the Democrats, but they're so dispirited and they're so demobilized that nothing is emerging to take their place.
I mean, the loyalists, for the Democratic Party loyalists are the middle class, like, you know, New York Times liberals, the Wokies, and then the PMC red lips.
And I think there is a class first segment of the Democratic left, which is, you know, these progressive, you know, types who like Medicare for All and things like that. And, you know, those people that are still staying in the Democratic Party, they're just doormats. They're loyal opposition. They're getting no concessions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, they're comfortable as they are, so they can afford to do this symbolic thing.
Right. Well, and this is where Biden's problems with Gaza are interesting, because this is the first time that just the degree of frustration from regular, not just even activist leftoids, but just regular rank and file boomer Democrats is so large that even organizations like DSA are kind of performatively denouncing Biden.
Oh yeah, I see. You saw the AOC speech where she's talking about this.
Right, even AOC's calling it a genocide. Right, so it's like the activist base and the regular rank and file Democratic voter are really, really angry, and this issue is kind of catalyzing a lot of disgust with Biden, with the Democratic Party. But that disgust is not being channeled into any alternative electoral vehicle, right? It's being channeled into just voting non-committed, voting just, you know, blanket rejection, but there's no alternative. Whereas in the UK, you have, you know, Galloway, and we'll see how he actually does, how the Workers' Party of Britain does in the next elections. But there is an alternative here. There's some kind of political formation that's emerging, like in Germany, right, with Wagenknecht. There's an alternative. But in the United States, there's no alternative. There's nothing that...
Tina.
Right. There's nothing.
Yeah, well, nothing yet. I mean, what we need to do is build an independent political organization which is doing politics on the basis of class, without the donor class, beyond the duopoly, without being in the patronage networks of the Republicans or the Democrats. And, you know, like Bernie Sanders says, you know, $27 coming from normal people fuels the actions to solve the problems of the people who give the $27. And then you're not beholden to anybody. That was the message. That's the formula.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the formula.
And it came pretty close to working.
Right? I just need an organization that will do that.
Right.
By formula, you mean member-funded, member-driven.
Member-funded, member-driven. The members express the problems in the funds, and in the action go to addressing the problems.
Right.
This isn't magic, and there's no, and you know, alchemy doesn't work. You have to figure out the formula, and you have to do what works, and that seems to be it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the U.S. is so... You look at how bad things are in the U.K., and you realize that the U.S. has had, like, 30 years more degeneration of working-class politics than the U.K. has, right? So we're, like, 30 years more degenerate than what's happening in Britain, probably more than that in other European countries like France or Germany, right? The American public has lost the kind of historical memory of what collective working class politics looks like to a degree that the British public has not lost it, right? The people like the Jody Brar, you know, who is in the Workers' Party of Great Britain, she can speak like that because she's she lives in a context where people remember what it was like to have a workers' movement. In the United States, no one remembers
and to strike.
Right? It has not existed in living memory.
Oh, it's mythology. It's a legend. It's like you know, it's like managers who dress like, you know, they wear the denim, they dress like coal miners because it's a fashion statement or right. something. I mean, it's just pure, it's purely aesthetic. There's no real connection.
Yeah. So I think that's the kind of concern I have, right? Like, Galloway is this very tenuous example of, yeah, if you just do fucking normal politics, you can actually reach the working class and you can get them on board. But in the United States, it's like the level of political apathy is so much higher, right? It's so much harder to reach people. People have responded to the collapse of political alternatives like Bernie, not by abandoning the mainstream parties for kind of fringe alternatives, but by simply abandoning politics entirely.
Yeah, there's one thing Jody Brar said in that bit, which I thought was, I saw that and I thought, wow, that's really fantastic. Just to hear something like that, it seems like it's from another time, but you know, you say it's from Britain. She says, the working class as it is, not the working class as you'd have it be. You go out and you talk to people, you see where they're at. They might say things you don't like. They might think things you don't like. It doesn't matter. If you're into class politics, you're into them because they're the working class. And the thing is, I think, in I don't know how it is in the UK, but in North America, people who call themselves leftists, they take this attitude more like something like this. Like, if your beliefs don't pass the litmus test, then you're not worthy of healthcare,
right.
basically. And so class politics is not possible for the American left. So let's say left of liberalism, maybe people in the DSA or so forth. I mean, the idea they're repulsed by normal people and they can't connect with most people. They think most people are repugnant because most people don't have the right views or sophisticated views or, you know, are uncouth or unrefined or I don't know what. But for instance, if you think that there should be some border policy, well, that's just beyond the pale. We can't even interact with these people. And the point is, I mean, if you're going to do politics, you don't really have a choice. And so in a certain sense, George Galloway just connecting with people, what people actually think can provide some victories. Because if you actually connect with what people think and their concerns, maybe they'll come out for you. Maybe the reason that no one is voting, maybe the reason that suddenly people voted for Obama who didn't vote before and then were disappointed and vote for Trump is because they knew that nobody was representing what they actually think and connecting with what they actually think.
Yeah. the American working class, we're seeing realignment towards the Republicans, right? I think it's something like the Republican voter share of the black community has like tripled or something in the last year in terms of what the polling data indicates. So we're seeing large numbers of working class voters abandoning the Democrats for the Republicans. But of course, the Republicans have not given them any actual reason to do that.
Right.
This is a sign of pure frustration. The Republicans are not any better than the Democrats on any issue.
You can see some Republicans shifting a little bit their rhetoric.
Right.
But
in terms of policy, not really.
Right.
Not in any major way, certainly.
Right, right.
And maybe some things here and there, but...
Right. So, you know, the extent to which this realignment, which people have been talking about, you know, towards kind of a populist Republican coalition, I don't know. I'm...
The sense in which there is a realignment is the sense in which the population, its views on things are changing, and the milk is curdled. People, you can't uncurdle milk. It's too late.
Yeah.
The turning point has come and gone, and people feel differently about things. I think there isn't this optimism that there was before the aughts and the global financial crisis of 2007, 2008, 2009. People don't feel patriotic in the same way that, you know, you had Democrats voting for the Iraq War and everyone waving a flag and all of this. I remember that was my political coming of age, and I just thought, what the fuck is wrong with you people?
Yep.
But people felt good about stuff still. And the thing is, when you have right wingers making statements against American geopolitical policies, I mean, that is a thermometer telling you that, you know,
the wheels are coming off.
It's not. Yeah, I mean, it's really not working.
Right. Yeah, I think this is kind of, you know, whether there's some kind of political institution that will channel this discontent, I don't know. It doesn't seem like there will be. Eventually there will be, but at the moment you can't really identify where it'll come from. But it's clear that the situation is growing increasingly untenable. The establishment controls things just barely. Popular discontent is kind of undermining the foundation of the system that the establishment needs to continue to control the world as it does, right? Like, the army, for example, is facing a recruiting crisis that is just, like, has basically crippled it. Like, the Navy can no longer staff ships.
Amazing.
Like, recruitment is down so much that, you know, if the U.S. had to do a serious war, you know, like, people are saying that the U.S. could not invade Iraq today if it wanted to.
Huh.
The Iraq war could not be done with the American army in the shape it is, because it just doesn't have the capacity.
So all that they need to do is do a forced conscription, and then there will be an insurrection.
Right, exactly. So eventually, push will come to shove, China will invade Taiwan, the U.S. will institute a draft, and the establishment will realize that, oh shit, the social compact was broken 40 years ago, and no one cares, and no one is willing to die for our games anymore, right? I think that's kind of what's happening under the scenes, and it may not manifest at the ballot box, but eventually there will be some sort of crisis.
Well, it's already happening. I mean, this is how it's going to play out American style. It's going to be a slumlord oligarch who embodies all of the least attractive aspects of the cliche American, and he's going to be repugnant, and then the establishment's going to try to make sure that it doesn't work because he says the quiet part out loud. It's not going to be a DSA blue hair. You know what it's going to be? It's going to be a queen slumlord with a comb over. I mean, it's already here, right?
Yeah, but
and I'm not saying that it's good, but I'm saying, you know, this is the way it's going to play out is not the convenient way. It's already sort of happening. The only alternative to this is also shit. This is, you know, that's what else would you expect?
Yeah, but I mean, so the thing about Trump is that the establishment was able to absorb his administration pretty effectively, right? Like, there was no, in terms of foreign policy, for example, Trump.
Why do they hate him so much?
Trump personally is obviously not a Russia hawk, right? Like, Trump personally has no interest in fighting the war in Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. But Trump staffed his administration last time with hardened establishment neocons, yeah, with guys like Mike Pompeo and shit, right? Like, so the establishment, obviously Trump is controlled opposition just as much as
sure.
guy like Corbyn was, right? Sure. Maybe even more so. But,
well, I don't think it's, I mean, because we'll look at the difference in the distance they went. I mean,
yeah,
Trump got elected and Corbyn, I mean, sort of wimped out. He didn't really fight back at all, did he?
Right,
I mean,
right.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, what Donald Trump did was better or something, but I mean, it seems like he's more of a fighter than Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, or maybe he was considered to be less of a threat, right? Like, the Republican Party.
Is Jeremy Corbyn really a threat?
Well, the British establishment thought he was enough of a threat that the Labour Party staff sabotaged his campaign, right? That didn't really happen to Trump. Like, the Republican Party apparatus was perfectly happy to win an election for Trump, right?
All I'm saying is this. There's someone who's running for Republican who all the Republicans don't like. In the 90s, he was a Democrat. He doesn't seem to be either thing. He's just a sort of weird mutant.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it comes that there's an alternative, it comes to be that there's an alternative in America, something else. By that, I just mean right. something else than the standard fair duopoly options. It might not be something you want to have.
Oh, yeah. It'll be something like Trump, but more competent, maybe, or
maybe more incompetent.
Right.
Maybe we should end. We should end maybe on the thought. There's this thing. So I've been hearing about it for a long time, but George Galloway seems like a good example, and Sarah Wagenknecht too, who we should talk about sometime. She, by the way, her book is great. If you can read it, the self-righteous. The idea of patriotic socialism, some people get really weirded out about this.
Make Rochdale great again.
Is that what he said?
That's what he said.
It really weirded some people out. And I thought maybe we could conclude on this note, like a round of thoughts about this. I'll go first so that you all go last. One thought I think, so I'm not on Twitter. I'm not familiar with any of this. I don't know what you call it, even like people talk about MAGA communism or whatever. This kind of
that
weirdo stuff.
It's Twitter, TikTok, kind of Zoomer memes, I think.
Right. Well, you got that on the one hand, and it's kind of weird. On the other hand, you've got these sort of standard DSA leftists who say that's like crypto fascism or whatever. To those types, I would just say, pointing to people like George Galloway or Sarah Wagenknecht, look at every single socialist government in the last century. It has been every actually existing one. It has been an attempt to resist global capitalist imperialism on a national basis. Every single one has been, you know, a war of national liberation against colonial or imperial occupiers, and it's been waged on a national basis. And nationalism is the only thing which has had any durable, lasting power. Everyone thought that it's ideology, and now, you know, it's beyond ideology, it's all markets. No, I'm afraid nationalism has lasting power. People care about where they live, they care about their communities, they care about their families, and these things are deeply out of fashion with upper middle class leftists. The point is, they're not out of fashion with most people.
Yep.
And so, you know, you might want to think about that when you do politics. And George Galloway is a good example. Like, I mean, maybe he's a bit eccentric or controversial or whatever, but I mean, it seems to have cracked the code and presented the formula. Connect with people on the basis of these things and stop doing your weirdo abolish the family leftism,
yeah,
and you might succeed.
Yeah, I mean, it's been obvious that this is the way forward, that you just do normal, you know, culturally center conservative, economically very redistributionist politics, and that's what most people want, right? But you have to actually do it. And Galloway actually did it. Wagenknecht is actually doing it. Another example is Robert Fico in Slovakia, who is basically an unreformed Soviet-era, you know, communist, whose political party opposes the Ukraine war. And, you know, so we have examples of this working. The problem is that the activist left really doesn't like this and is willing to lose elections rather than try it, right? And as long as they're the ones in the driver's seat, they're, you know, they will always choose to lose elections rather than do this. And to create an alternative working class formation without relying at all on those people is difficult, you know? Like, it's hard to spin something up out of nothing. The temptation is always going to be, oh, well, we have all these kind of enthusiastic young people who really like socialism. Let's kind of throw them a bone here or there. Let's, you know, do the pronoun rituals that they want. Let's talk about systematic racism or whatever.
Systemic
racism.
And, come on.
Right. And that way they'll, like, door knock for our campaign. But when you do that, you're sending a message to the voters that you're trying to appeal to that actually you don't care about them. You know, like, your priorities are these idiots' priorities. And the stuff that you're saying about economic policies that will benefit them, actually you're not super interested in that. And that's why these parties fail. And,
well, they're paid to fail, though, so it's...
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it would... Galloway has been able to, and Wagenknecht, I think, we'll see how she does in the next German elections. We'll see how both of them do in their next respective national elections. But they've both been able to show kind of a roadmap for, yeah, if you actually do it, it can actually work.
Right.
But whether there are enough people, for example, on the American activist left who will say, hey, let's give it a try, versus the people who will just continue to say, oh, no, this is all racism. We couldn't possibly do that. I don't know. I don't think it'll happen.
Yeah, I mean, these points are all obvious. We all in class, you know, we love to say, you know, class politics, not identity politics. I think, you know, if you're running for office, you do need to be sensitive to the identities of your constituents. The problem with the left is it focuses on the, you know, smallest and supposedly most oppressed identity groups. And the one, you know, the identities that
entrepreneurs, namely.
Entrepreneurs.
They're the suppressed identity group. Never mind.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and the one they ignore is that of the majority. So in George Galway's case, that was Rochdale. He says, I'm proud to be from Rochdale. Rochdale used to be great. Let's make it great again. You know, in the United States, a lot of people either, you know, they're really proud to be American, you know, real, you know, hot-blooded patriots, or, you know, they might not put that at the front and center, but they still identify as American, and they see themselves as, say, having American values. That's normal. Everybody does that. So yeah, if you want to win the majority, you need to be at the very least, you know, accommodating of that. So yeah, the fact that, you know, the subcultural lifestyle left, really hates that, just tells you how much they hate to win,
and how much they hate the majority, I think.
Right. Yeah. Well, and Galloway's brilliance was that he was able to in a very clear-eyed fashion identify issues that appealed both,
yes,
to regular people, particular identity groups, and, you know, the activist left base, without alienating the other parts, mm-hmm, of his coalition. This is the basic politics that Galloway was able to do that the activist left to its own, mm-hmm, devices refuses to do.
Well, right? Because they come down like from on high from management, because they're basically HR, right, all, right, day, 9 to 5, and then they come down and tell workers what they're going to do now and how they're going to vote, and then they say fuck you, and then you lose.
Right.
But, you know, it is true. That's just wise political realism from a old left perspective. Find out what those people around there care about.
Right.
Are there any problems in your area? What are they?
Right.
Find out what they are. Speak to them. People will come.
Right.
But if you keep saying like, oh, the problem with you is that you're privileged and that you enjoy these privileges and you're racist, you know,
right,
you're,
right,
not going to get far.
And you compare the sort of the minority outreach that Galloway did, right? Basically saying, I'm going to speak out against the genocide in Gaza. You compare that to the kind of minority outreach that the activist left does, left to its own devices, where Galloway picked an issue that was very important to a particular ethno-religious community within his district, but that also did not alienate, right, other parts of his coalition. Whereas the activist left picks the most niche issue that appeals to, yeah, the most minoritarian group and is the most alienating
and
to
divisive
everyone else, right?
And if, yeah, you don't like it, fuck you. You're
right.
You're to blame for everything.
Right. Like I'm reminded of kind of the activist left attempt to perform outreach to Chinese voters in my ward here in Chicago. Where they had these posters like about this white girl, hipster white girl, who's saying that she's going to quote unquote like uplift the Chinese community. And it's like, that's not what Chinese people want to hear. Like, they don't give a shit about uplifting.
Well,
the
she
Chinese
doesn't give
community
a shit about what they want,
right,
to hear.
But like,
and that's why she didn't win.
Right. Well, she didn't win because what the Chinese people, what the Chinese community of Chicago cares about is crime and getting the refugees out of their public spaces, right?
And not having their Amazon packages stolen.
Right. And the left can't give them that because for obvious reasons. So, you know, they have to resort to platitudes. Whereas Galloway was willing to say, hey, this is what you care about. I'm going to give it to you, right? I will say what you want me to say, and I'm not going to mince my words, and I'm not going to be afraid to alienate the establishment. I'm just going to tell it like it is, and it works.
And that's why he's so maligned.
Yeah, that's why he's so maligned. But, yeah, it's why he won.
All right, folks.